It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. In 1989, Bill McKibben published his groundbreaking book, The End of Nature, one of the very first books about climate change written for a general audience. 26 years, more than a dozen books, many articles, and countless speeches and media appearances later, he's still working to get the word out, working hard to educate people about climate change and rallying activists around the world in an effort to do something before it's too late. He spoke yesterday at Grinnell College's commencement ceremony, and we recorded this interview shortly before he spoke. Good morning, Bill.
Good morning, Charity. How are you?
Great. Thank you so much for being here this morning. And there was a piece of news that spread around social media very quickly last week. NASA released a statement on Friday citing evidence that the remaining portion of the Larsen B ice shelf in Antarctica will be gone within the next 5 years. Now, you and climate scientists around the world have been predicting things like this for decades. When they actually happen, how do you feel?
It's a very good question. You know, I did write the first book about all this, and it was a quarter century ago. And in a strange way, I think I got through an awful lot of the angst and dread and catharsis and all of that, which is good because it lets me go ahead and do the work that needs to be done now without being overcome every time there's another sign of just how bad things are getting. On the other hand, it really is just a kick in the gut every week when a new issue of Nature or Science arrives and there's yet another study or yet another illustration like the one from the Antarctic of just what trouble we're in. You know, for a long time, felt as if it was like one of those nightmares where you could see some terrible monster coming, but you couldn't wake anybody else up. You couldn't make enough noise for anyone else to alarm anybody else. Now, finally, we've got this movement sort of building, and there's people beginning to pay attention. And in that way, it's though it's desperate times scientifically, and there's always some despair that comes, there's also at least the sense that there are now enough other people paying attention that we've got a fighting chance to slow this down.
As I mentioned, I mean, you work very hard to rally people to activism and to educate people about the realities of climate change. Do you still feel like you're trying to convince non-believers, too?
At this point, the challenge, I think, is not to take the last 20% of the population that refuses to believe in physics and try to convert them. The kind of dead-enders at this point are, you know, that way for ideological reasons, not scientific ones. The real task is to get the 70 or 80% of people who realize we face a serious problem to get them engaged. And I think the biggest reason, the hardest and most paradoxical reason that that's so difficult is because climate change seems so large, and against it we seem so small, our individual efforts so unavailing, that there's almost a temptation to just skip it and go on to those things that we can do something about. And I think that's why we've worked so hard to build movements. You know, 7 or 8 years ago, we started 350.org, myself and seven college students, and it's become the first great international grassroots climate campaign that we organize in pretty much every country on earth. And we were able to get 400,000 people in the streets of New York last fall. And one of the reasons for doing that is to help people understand that though as individuals, we can't do very much about climate change, if we stop being individuals for a while and join together, then we have a chance at rearranging some of the structures and systems that keep us so addicted to fossil fuel past the point where it's necessary now that we have alternatives.
You're working so hard to galvanize people into action. What was your crucible moment? What made you feel like you needed to dedicate your life to this?
You know, I knew when I started writing about it, Charity, that it was a great story of our time. I wrote the first book about it. I kept writing and thinking about it. But sometime 7 or 8 years ago, it sort of really began clear to me that I'd in a certain way misinterpreted the situation. I think like many writers and academics, my thought was that if we kept writing more books and eventually we'd convince everybody that the problem was lack of data. But, you know, we actually won this argument 20 years ago. The science was incredibly clear. We won the argument, but we lost the fight because the fight wasn't about data. The fight was, as fights usually are, about power. And the fossil fuel industry, which is the richest industry on Earth, had all the power. So for me, the kind of intellectual understanding that what we needed to do was build a movement that could match the money power of the fossil fuel industry with the people power that occasionally arises in the civil rights movement or something like that. That's what we needed to do. That's what we're trying to do. It's beginning to happen, but whether we can catch up with the physics or not is a very open and very daunting question.
You have built this strong movement with 350.org. What do you think works? What do people need to hear to get them to act?
I think they need to hear that there are, real possibilities, and there really are. In the last 6 or 7 years, I will say to the kids at Grinnell, in the time that they've been in college, in the last 4 years, the price of a solar panel has dropped 70% or 80%. What was once hard to imagine, sort of pie in the sky, is now everyday reality. Yesterday, the Danes generated 110% of the power that they used from windmills in Denmark that are selling the rest to the rest of Europe. People in Iowa have some sense that these kind of changes are possible. So people need to understand that, and then they need to understand that the reason we're not doing it is because of the blocking power of the fossil fuel industry, that they systematically used their wealth to keep things from changing. The Koch brothers, taken together, the two of them are the richest man on Earth, they've announced that they're going to use $900 million of their oil and gas fortune on the next presidential election. They'll spend more than the Republican National Committee or the Democratic National Committee, Koch brothers, party of two. As people start to realize the stakes and the possibilities, more and more of them are moved to action, and that's what we need.
Well, let's talk about the kind of action that you're trying to inspire with 350.org. And for people who aren't familiar with the organization, the website that you have, it explains the name. The number 350 means climate safety. To preserve a livable planet, scientists tell us we must reduce the amount of CO2 in the atmosphere from its current level of 400 parts per million to below 350 parts per million. So that's where you took the inspiration from. But as you said earlier, there's so little we can do as individuals. Right now, the major effort, it seems, of 350.org is to convince colleges and universities to do away with their investments in oil and gas companies. Why do you think that's so important?
Well, that's important because it's a way, as it was with apartheid 30 years ago, to undermine the political power of this industry. Divestment is a rarely used tactic, but occasionally an effective one. And so in this case, now something like 200 colleges, universities, denominations, foundations have divested. Maybe the high point came last September when the Rockefeller family, the first family of fossil fuel, announced that they were selling their holdings in coal and oil and gas because they thought it was neither financially prudent nor moral to continue to invest in the wreckage of the planet. So that's one of the things that we do. And the other probably biggest task that we're about is trying to slow down and stop the worst new fossil fuel industry projects. So we sort of helped inaugurate the fight against the Keystone Pipeline and all the other kind of projects like it that have come down the path. At the moment, an awful lot of the action is in the Pacific Northwest, where everyone's rallying to try and stop or slow down the rush to drill for oil in the Arctic.
I can imagine some people listening to you and thinking, well, all right, it's clear what you're fighting against. What are you fighting for?
What we're fighting for is the quick transition to renewable energy. Everybody knows that in 50 or 60 years, we're going to be running this planet on sun and the wind, that's what's coming. If we can do it in 10 or 20 years instead, then we can't stop global warming. Too late for that. But we can keep it from getting entirely out of control. And it's now possible. The Germans, there were days last summer when the Germans were generating 80% of the power they were using from the sun in Germany, you know, at a latitude north of Iowa. That that's now possible means that we no longer have any excuse for not going whole hog in that direction, for turning public policy and public energy, just as we did at the start of World War II, when we needed to go from making cars to making tanks and planes. In this case, we need to turn our energy in very desperately toward the task of switching over our energy systems in new ways. That comes at a great cost to the small number of people who make a huge fortune off fossil fuel. The good news is that in economic terms, it should empower all the rest of us. There's a huge number of jobs, and once the job is complete, you're no longer sending money every month to Saudi Arabia. You're sending money to your neighbors or to yourself if you're lucky enough, like I do, to have a solar panel up on your roof.
I think a lot of people, when they think about climate change, of course, they don't want to see it continue. But the idea of changing how we live is a really hard pill for a lot of people to swallow.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that that's necessary? Do we need to change our personal behavior?
Well, we need to change some of it. But the most important, I mean, the good news is that we probably need to change it somewhat less than we'd imagine. The quick work of the engineers in making things like solar panels cheap and efficient gives us an opportunity to transition gracefully, not slowly, but gracefully in new directions. But yeah, I mean, there are things that are harder to imagine. The idea that everybody in the world is just going to, at the drop of a hat, get on a jet airplane and go someplace else because it's a little warmer, like a vacation, that's harder to imagine in a world that was taking climate change seriously. But can you have hot showers and cold beer? Yep.
Can I drive my SUV?
If you're determined to have an SUV, the good news is that Tesla now will give you a nice electric one. The price is coming down real fast. I drive a plug-in electric Ford hybrid C-Max, and I can get pretty much everything that I need in the back of it. So if you can't ride a bike and you can't take the bus, then make sure what you're driving is powered by what's on your roof.
There does seem to be this kind of peculiar psychological problem with people, and that is even when we understand problems, we seem to prefer treatment to prevention. I mean, you see it with healthcare all the time. It takes a heart attack or a diabetes crisis or something like that for a lot of people to say, okay, I need to take care of my health. What kind of heart attack do you think it's going to take for for our nation to wake up, our world to wake up to this?
We've been having a series of at least small strokes. I mean, you all remember the summer of 2012, which was the hottest year in American history so far. In 2012, when trillions of kernels of corn across Iowa did not germinate because it wasn't, did not fertilize because it was just too hot. The temperature was up above 95 day after day after day. People in California now are living on the precipice of an unprecedented drought. You know, we've already watched most of the summer sea ice in the Arctic melt. We've watched our oceans become 30% more acidic. These are the equivalent of pretty major strokes now. So the question is when we're going to actually get serious about taking care of ourselves. That's why one of the reasons we called this outfit 350.org. One reason was we needed a number because we were going to work around the world and numbers translate better than words do. But the other reason, people said, oh, it's too depressing. We're already past 350 parts per million CO2. It'll depress people. And I never thought so. I think it's the equivalent to going to the doctor. And the doctor says, you know what? Your cholesterol's too high now. Not it's going to be too high someday. It's too high now. You're in the zone where people have heart attacks. And that's the moment, finally, at which people say, okay, what pill do I take? And where do I sign up for the fitness center? Time for us to do the same thing as a planet.
Speaking of how depressing it is to talk about climate change and how overwhelming it is, when kids learn about climate change and the environmental problems that, of course, they haven't done anything to contribute to, or at least not directly, how do you get kids excited about making change and loving nature and willing to protect it when there's sort of this gloom and doom yep. message?
It's a very, very, very perceptive question. And I always tell people, do not harass your seven-year-old with, you know, worries about the global environment. People do not fall in love with terminally ill people for the most part because it's too painful. And in the same way, if people perceive, kids perceive everything around them is in mortal danger, they'll flee from it and straight into the arms of the PlayStation. Instead, help kids fall in love with the world around them, confident that if you can do that, they will rise to its defense when the time comes. And indeed, it's young people all over the world who are taking the lead in this fight now. And that's why it's so much fun to be at a place like Grinnell and know that these kids will be deeply engaged in this fight.
And what is your main message to the graduates at Grinnell?
Well, the main message is congratulations. The main message is this is a huge problem about which the preceding generations have not done enough, and you won't do enough either if you treat it as a problem to be addressed individually, one person at a time. The most important thing we can do as individuals in a fight like this is not the individuals quite so much. It's come together into movements. I think, you know, the day that you graduate from college is kind of the day that they take the training wheels off on your citizenship, you know, and it's the day in which people really need to start conceiving of themselves as powerful and useful, especially if they can figure out how to join together. And kids can, you know, look, this is the generation that grew up understanding Facebook and Twitter. They have an intuitive sense, a visceral sense of connection that people my age lack sometimes. So I have great hope for what they'll be able to do.
Bill McKibben, thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Bill McKibben, best-selling author and environmental activist, he spoke at the commencement ceremony at Grinnell College yesterday. His most recent book is Oil and Honey, The Education of an Unlikely Activist. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbie.